It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Today is Tuesday. It's July 30th. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and I'm sure you well know that when it's Tuesday, Richard Narog, co-host of the show, is here. However, he's got other responsibilities this week, and I understand even next. So we're going to have to struggle without him, which is no easy feat, let me tell you. So we've got some great guests, though, who are going to pinch hit for his absence. And the first guest, of course, in the opening hour will be Yonkers Fire Department President from Local 628, Barry McGoey. In the second hour, we'll be speaking with author John F. McMullen, both on the Westchester On the Level show. And with Mr. McGoey, he's just recently returned from Albany. And when, as you probably well know, is when the New York State Legislature adjourned the 2013 session, they ended up not touching the compulsory arbitration law. It was suspected, and it was almost threatened, that the arbitration law would not be extended. And that was intimated to be a solution to some of the financial difficulties that some cities, certainly in the state of New York, were under, and the constraints, the financial constraints, the burdens of pensions, the burdens of employment, of union members, despite the fact that, for example, the union membership of the Yonkers Fire Department, they have not had a contract for almost 5 years. Same goes for the police department. I don't know what the exact length of time without a contract is from the DPW workers, the Teamsters Union, and others, SEIU, CSEA. This Yonkers is a major, major union town. I think we have 10 unions altogether, and yet none have gotten a contract. So the anticipation by some, depending on what side of the equation you were on, steered you toward saying, oh, yeah, go gung-ho, and let the governor just bring down this arbitration law, compulsory arbitration law, so that it would weaken the hand of the union membership over the promises made to the unions over many, many years. So we find ourselves in a situation here which I don't know if it's appropriate to put all the blame on fiscal irresponsibility, literally on the back of the worker. I really question whether that is the case. And I guess one of the biggest issues has always been, in my mind, well, you know, if we're looking for leadership, then maybe somebody should lead rather than so that's why you have the leaders. That's why you have elected officials. And evidently, from my perspective, so just so you know where I'm at, I don't believe that we've had leadership on this issue. And leadership to me means if you expect somebody to do something, then you should also be expected to do the same, if not to a greater extent. So I don't see the clarity in this problem, and I also don't see why responsibility should fall on the shoulders of the ones least able to foot the bill. I mean, didn't we go through this when we went through that crisis with the banks out of control? They were hoping to make money, and they did hand over fist. And it looks like our guest is on. Good morning.
Good morning, Hezzy. Good morning.
Good morning. Barry McGoey on the phone with us now. So just quickly allow me just to finish my thought. And then we'll be right back to you. So, you know, I guess it seems like it's a different situation, but, you know, why should the taxpayer have to bail out the banks? They've been ripping us off all along. And I say to you that the government has been doing that to us for a very long time also. Anyway, so I digress. Let's go on to the major issue. And so good morning, Barry. Thanks for coming on to the show.
Good morning, Hezzy. Thanks for having me.
It's really a pleasure. You know, I think you just came back and you from Albany and you were talking to them, I would presume, up there about the compulsory arbitration law, about the New York State Legislature adjourning their session and not curtailing that law. And then there's the Public Employment Relations Board. All those things are very complicated. Maybe we could start from the very, very beginning, you know, because even hearing terms like PERB, Public Employment Relations Board, it blew me the first time I heard about it. I said, what is he talking about? So tell us what caused you to go up to Albany? What were you interested in finding out or learning or inputting into the discussion that took place there?
Well, we were up there to basically have a conference amongst many firefighter unions to discuss the impact of the new legislation regarding interest arbitration, as well as to have some high-level meetings with some people in state government regarding the changes to interest arbitration. Now, as you said, go back to the beginning. The PERB is the New York State Public Employees Relations Board, and they're basically in charge of all collective bargaining agreements between municipalities and public sector workers, police, fire, sanitation, school teachers, basically everybody that works for the government. And there's different divisions of PERB, and there's specific rules regarding police and fire, and that's why we have interest arbitration. That's a word that, you know, a term that's used frequently, but I think misunderstood by many people. Mm-hmm. And the goal of PERB is to ensure that we maintain the critical public safety services to citizens and not have strikes and work stoppages, but in return that the employer, the municipalities, have to maintain existing agreements until a new agreement is negotiated. And if that can't happen, then there's PERB mechanisms to allow for the appointment of a mediator and potentially binding arbitration, and for police and mm-hmm. fire, that's called interest arbitration. And that's binding and non-appealable.
Well, based on that, and that's a great foundation, what were the changes that took place in the 2013 state legislature? How did they change from the previous years to those issues that will confront us into the future?
We've basically had binding interest arbitration for over 35 years in the state of New York.
Right.
And that was a result in the 60s and 70s, there were quite a number of strikes by many municipal employees, including police and fire. And there actually was both a police strike in Yonkers and a fire strike in the city of Yonkers,
mm-hmm.
As well as throughout the rest of the state. So we have these PERB rules that have been basically in effect for decades and decades. And they've been extended every so often, every 3 or 4 years. They come up for renewal and have been extended basically outright. But based upon the latest economic crisis facing the entire state, as well as the country, there was a lot of political pressure to not extend binding arbitration by people who are making those arguments that really don't comprehend. Excuse me one second. They really don't comprehend the whole process and how it works. And they think they're going to get some kind of instant resolution, which is not the case. So the governor.
And what they were looking for, in a sense, is really for the unions to pay or relieve the financial pressure by denying, you know, the arbitration to take place. Isn't that the case? Isn't that like the gist of most of their effort?
Well, the effort was really to at first, to totally weaken and destroy interest arbitration. Basically,
yeah.
The municipalities would have the utmost upper hand in negotiations with labor organizations that represent the police and firefighters that work in their jurisdictions. That didn't pass muster in the budget process. So then
mm-hmm.
after the budget had been adopted, the governor had another alternative, which was to basically create this list of fiscally distressed, and because many municipalities didn't like to be on a fiscally distressed list, they changed the terminology to say fiscally eligible.
Uh-huh.
So if you were a fiscally eligible municipality, which most, I think almost every city in the state of New York, as well as most major towns and other municipal subdivisions are fiscally distressed, or could readily manipulate their books to become fiscally distressed or fiscally eligible, then the new rules would apply. And that would be that an independent arbitrator would have to apply the ability to pay, a municipality's ability to pay, in fashioning any award that was given at interest arbitration. And to apply the arbitrator must apply 70% of the decision to the ability
mm-hmm.
to pay.
And the being on this list is a hard definition, isn't it? That was part of the nebulousness of what was permitted to extend into the next 3-year term of this arbitration board, the PERB board. Is that one of the issues there, or is that just a way out?
The problem is it's a political way out for politicians who really don't understand how things work. We have very temporary placeholders in these offices, and people come in like Governor Cuomo, and it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all games to try to make themselves look good, to make look like they're being fiscally constrained. They're looking out for the taxpayers. I mean, we look at we've had in the last 4 years, we've had two different variations of pension reform. Neither one of them has provided the city of Yonkers or any city with one penny of relief.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't be many, it'll be decades before they realize any type of relief to the municipalities. So now when we hire a new police officer or a firefighter in the city of Yonkers or basically anywhere throughout the state, that police officer or firefighter will be contributing 6% towards the cost of their pension.
Uh-huh.
The municipality is not going to pay 6% less. The municipality is going to be paying the same they were. The only difference is now there'll be additional monies going into the pension system, which is already 97% fully funded. We have one of the best funded pension systems in the country. This is not Detroit. This is not Michigan. This is the state of New York that has the control of Tom DiNapoli as the sole trustee. And it's because of his good stewardship and the people prior to him that we have a very well-funded pension system in the state of New York. So, we could talk about all these pension reforms and what it's going to do, but it's not going to save the city of Yonkers one penny. Didn't save them for the last 3 years, next year, or probably it'll be 10 years before they realize even minuscule amounts of savings because of these pension contributions. And in effect, what we've done is taking money that's paid by the city of Yonkers to its police officers and firefighters. And now instead of those police officers and firefighters spending that money and increasing the economic activity of the city, that money is going up into the coffers in Albany to fund the pension system in the hopes that someday it'll alleviate some of the pension obligations to the municipalities. And, that's like the fraud of it. So, I wish some of the mayors and leaders of some of the municipalities throughout New York State would call on Governor Cuomo on the sham that it really is. And they stand there, talk about pension reform and they're doing this, and they say that they're helping municipalities. The municipalities are dying. We can't fund school systems where it costs $25,000 per student with property taxes anymore. It can't be done. It might have been able to do it 50 years ago, 60 years ago, but we look at these municipalities. A very small percentage of the property taxes in the city of Yonkers goes to provide city services. the vast majority of the money goes to, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75% to 80%, goes to provide education. Mm-hmm. So we have many people, especially senior citizens and people on fixed incomes, that are being squeezed to pay for the school systems, which, you know, now it's not the school system that you went to. You know, mm-hmm. it was reading, writing, arithmetic. Now we have, you know, we have troubled youth in many of the schools that need extra help. We have so many people that need special education. And these are mandated expenditures for school districts and cities to provide services. Then we have such an influx of non-English-speaking student base. And it's not just Spanish. We, in City of Yonkers, I think they said they had 30 different languages spoken by the students.
Yeah.
So we had a tremendous influx of immigrants, and immigrants from different parts of the world than historically we've had. And, you know, they have special needs. And in addition to that, we have a large poverty base in these municipalities. You know, people that need services, government assistance, they flock to the cities. You're not gonna go to Bronxville if you require rent subsidies, public assistance, special education services, and WIC assistance, and all the other programs that are out there. So the municipalities, the large urban centers like Yonkers and Rochester, and Syracuse and Buffalo and White Plains and Rochelle, you know, they get a disproportionate amount of people that not only do they require significant additional services, but they're not providing the tax revenue to help pay for it. And these are services that are required. I mean, what are we going to do? Tell some poor non-English speaking student that needs special education he's not going to get it? You know, what kind of future would that person have? So we have an obligation as a society to provide many, many different services. But the funding stream, the historical funding stream, just doesn't work anymore. Do the math. I mean, we respond to, you know, to fires where it's a four-family house and there's 30 children living in a four-family house. So that landlord may be paying $15,000 to $20,000 in taxes to what? To pay for $1.5 million worth of educational expenses that live in the building?
Yeah.
You know, so I think the model is broken. Eventually the model will have to be fixed, but in the interim, what's happening is these municipalities, and Yonkers is no exception, are being squeezed, choked. And we have mayors and administrators that they feel like they have no other choice but to cut back on the essential services that they must provide. You know, we have an obligation to provide police and fire and sanitation services and parks and recreation for the citizens that actually pay a lot of money in taxes. But yet, because of all these mandates to provide all these services, these non-municipal services, let's say, you know, the municipalities are all squeezed. And then we have these politicians in Albany go around patting themselves in the back because, oh, we have pension reform, and it's not going to save a penny. This interest arbitration reform is not going to save them a penny. It's going to make them feel good like they did something. But in the end, the only thing they're doing is causing additional strife between the people that actually do the work that run a city. You know, a city or municipality is in the business of providing services. You know, I happen to have the good fortune of representing the Yonkers firefighters who provide one of the greatest services the city offers. And we're one of the best fire departments, if not the best, in the country.
Definitely.
And, you know, we haven't had a contract. And we're in our fifth year with no contract. Now, I pay taxes in City Yonkers. Every year, my taxes have gone up. But our salary hasn't gone up. There hasn't been one increase for a police or a firefighter since January 1st, 2009. But yet, so where's the money going? I'm not saying the politicians are putting it in their pockets, but they're being squeezed with all these other responsibilities. And then here we're left with, you know, police and firefighters and DPW workers that provide those services 24/7 throughout the year, and basically we're thrown to the curb and say there's nothing left for you guys. Matter of fact, we want everything you have. We want it back.
Well,
so it's created a very unfortunate circumstance for politicians going around patting themselves in the back, pretending they're doing something when they're not. And in the meantime, our municipalities are floundering. And, you know, I don't think there's any immediate threat of bankruptcy municipality in the state of New York. But if this continues for another decade or so, most certainly there will be. You know, and we send if you could calculate the amount of money that is sent up to Albany in this region, you know, it's this part of the state. It's people in Westchester County that are the highest income earners in the country. So a lot of money goes up to New York State in income taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then those people are buying things. You know, in Yonkers, we're buying the necessities of life, clothing and food, medications, and we're paying sales tax on that. But, you know, the people in Scarsdale and Brocksville are buying yachts, and they're paying sales tax, and all this money goes up to Albany, right? And then we have all the economic activity from New York City. And it goes up to Albany and should be redistributed back. And some of these people in Albany think it's their money. It's our money. We sent it up. You know,
yeah.
We sent up. You can't drive 15 minutes in this area of the country, in this area of the state, without hitting a toll.
Mm.
And all that toll revenue goes upstate. All the fees. You know, the vast majority of DMV fees are provided in this part of the country, in this part of the state. So all the fees and fines and taxes and everything else, all the revenue that's generated because of the economic activity of New York City and our Long Island brethren and our five counties here goes up, and we never seem to get an appropriate share redistributed back. So instead of us fighting the governor and the legislature, we're fighting amongst ourselves.
Yeah. I want to just take a quick break to advise people. This is Westchester on the Level. We've been hearing Yonkers Fire Department President Barry McGowey from Local 628 of the International Association of Firefighters. He's our guest this morning. I think you painted very clearly. I'm on there with you, hanging there with your rationale. And I'm wondering, why don't we have a discussion that points out that we're 97% funded on the pension side? Why do we fall so easily? And maybe this is not an issue that you can delve into, but it just seems that we're so easily swayed by these wonderful Madison Avenue marketing concepts, and they overwhelm us, and we never get anything resolved. It seems this whole issue has been kicked down the curb for so many years, and yet there are moments in that timeline to get things done and get things rectified, to start dealing with many issues. And yet over here we seem, in Yonkers, quite often we seem to be spending a great deal of money on the government side. The costs are going through the roof, but I don't see any union membership gaining any at least even just having a contract is ridiculous after 5 years. And there seems to be so little talk, and I don't understand that.
I think it's an overarching public policy debate that's being driven at a much, much higher level than, you know, localities such as Yonkers. We have extremely wealthy, basically right-wing, fiscal conservative Tea Party people like the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
That spend hundreds of millions of dollars because at the end of the day, they want to preserve their capital.
Yes.
They have a lot of money, and they don't want to be taxed on it. So they spend a lot of money to make sure that they're not taxed. Now, it's very politically incorrect for them to go out there and talk, well, we should cut all medical services to undocumented residents. You know, we shouldn't be providing ESL services in schools. We shouldn't be providing rent subsidies. So because there would be a gigantic political backlash. So they've taken their wrath and said, let's look at one of these other big expenditures, which is the salaries and pensions and benefits of people that work for government, because they're going to need our taxes to pay for that. And then we're talking about the really rich people that, you know, they could afford to pay their fair share. So they've created this climate to make police and firefighters, sanitation workers, teachers, the enemies. I mean, some of the things that have been said about teachers over the last several years just make me want to throw up.
Yeah.
I mean, the most precious thing any of us have are our children. And we send our children for, you know, 50 to 60% of their waking lives. We send them to school to be in the custody and care of teachers. And to see the vilification of teachers that's gone on over these last several years is disgusting. And it's also, they turn around and want to make the police officers who put their lives on the line every time, and firefighters who will risk their lives to save somebody in a time of need, and turn them out to be the problem of why taxes are so high. You know, the pension contributions are high, not because the pensions are out of control. Sure, are you going to have some odd cases where there's ridiculously high pensions? Yes. Most pensions are pretty normal. The reason why pension contributions are so high is because of Wall Street. And, you know, there was trillions of dollars, you know, too big to fail, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, AIG was too big to fail. But you know what? A police department and a fire department is too big to fail. A city is too big to fail. But because it was a financial institution, they were too big to fail. So they pumped trillions of dollars into Wall Street after they had raped and pillaged the public for years. And now they're back up to record booming profits again.
Yeah.
You know, no one wants to say that. You know, the pension system lost, I think, 50% of its value in a matter of a year because of what happened on Wall Street. And it's slowly coming back up. And eventually pension contributions will level off. The next biggest complaint that politicians seem to have is, of course, the health care. Well, you know, that's not something that's driven by the teacher who goes to the doctor. There's billions and billions of dollars of Medicaid fraud out there and Medicare fraud.
Yeah.
The medical, you know, every doctor's got to be a millionaire. You know, you go in for a surgery and it's a $9,000. I get the explanation of benefits, you know, for my family. And you see mm-hmm. the county have outrageous charges that are being charged by doctors and by medical facilities. But yet, we'll blame the cop, the fireman, the teacher because those health insurance costs are so high. But we're not going to blame the HMOs, the doctors, and the hospitals. Because you know what? They have hundreds of millions of dollars that they spend lobbying to pretend that they're looking out for the interest. But most of these people, you walk into a doctor's office, no one ever says, how you feeling? How can we help you today? What's your complaint? The first thing they want to do is, where's your insurance card and give me a $20 copay. But, right. You know, the cop is the villain. The firefighter is the villain. So most of these high expenditures for public service, for municipal workers, is driven by forces outside of the control of either the municipality or the workers. You know, we can't control what happens on Wall Street and why the pension contributions are high. I can't control the cost of health care. You know, and those are major expenditures. Of course, we understand that. And we understand the situation that municipalities are in. But the answer is not to turn around and to vilify the people that are actually providing services that make government work.
Well, that's what I never
So I think it's an overarching public policy debate at a much higher level. And we're no match for the Koch brothers. But
no,
it's unfortunate that so many public officials just fall for this.
Well, I never understood the reality of how could you be a city? How could you have a society that is you call a city if you haven't made a commitment to the fire department, to the police department, to the DPW workers, because that's what maintains the basic foundation. And then you build on that. You've got your teachers and your CSEA and your SEIU and all the different other unions. And I think there's something to be proud of saying that it's a union city. And why not? What's the problem with that? Because certainly the union, the remuneration of money to the workers, that hasn't gotten crazy.
And we, you know, sometimes want to point to because our salaries, you know, comparatively to some other jurisdictions, look high. But we live and work in, just like everybody's always saying, you know, Rob Astorino is so famous as saying that we're the highest tax county in the United States. Well, we pay those taxes too. And it's the highest place to buy a house in the entire country. And, you know, we pay a tremendous amount of the cost of living here is so much higher. So, of course, I mean, you can't compare a Yonkers firefighter salary to the firefighter in Tallahassee, Florida, when a house costs $39,000 in Tallahassee and the property taxes are $1,200 a year, and the schools are fantastic, and, you know, you don't have to have a heating bill.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything is comparative. You have to look at, you know, the geographic region that you're in. And I think, you know, we have, you know, current administration talking about, you know, contracts that were negotiated when times were good. You know, times haven't been good in Yonkers since the 1960s. Economically,
exactly.
We've had two control boards in the 70s and the 80s. We finally pulled out from under two major discrimination cases and settlements regarding the schools and housing, and it would cost a lot of money. So Yonkers hasn't been flush with money forever, and it wasn't too long ago that, you know, Nick Spano was in the Senate coming back down to Yonkers with $100 million 1 year, $90 million the next year. It's because Yonkers has been systematically underfunded in education and municipal aid compared to all these other cities throughout the major cities throughout the state. So it's not like the workers' fault that we have this big budget deficit. There's a systematic failure to address these decades-long inequities that exist. You know, we have artificially capped the taxes at 2%, and then that's the state mandates that. And then in return, instead of trying to give some of these municipalities some extra money to make up for the difference because they can't raise taxes to meet their expenditures, the state either reduces or freezes state aid. So what's a mayor to do?
Mm-hmm.
Can't raise taxes locally. The state's not giving them extra aid. You know, the federal aid is drying up. So, I mean, it's, all right, cut your essential services. Now, what are you left to cut? It's only those things that are not mandated. So, you know, you can't cut some of these mandated programs because, you know, there's the requirement and the penalties would be too severe if they cut
them.
So they have to go after, you know, the working man and women that's just trying to get through. You know, it's unfortunate. And it becomes this, you know, the intensity of the debate gets that much stronger because the firefighters, just like every other service provider in the city, we're very proud of the work that we do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to be discounted, and we think we should be treated fairly and equitably, like our contemporaries and our colleagues in other jurisdictions around us.
Yeah.
As I said, it's been since January 2009, no Yonkers firefighter or police officer has had any increase in salary. That's a long time. The price of milk has gone up considerably in the last 4 years. The price of a loaf of bread has gone up. Our car insurance has gone up. Our health insurance has gone up. You know, and we contribute a lot of money towards our health insurance. So, you know, and we were doing that a long time before it became sexy or politically popular. You know, Yonkers
mm-hmm.
firefighters have been contributing significant amounts to health insurance. So we find ourselves now with a mayor that walks in to office, and he has 2.5 years of expired contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and here we are a year and a half later, and we're into our fifth year with expired contracts. And, you know, it's, I don't know what the end game is going to be, but there's no doubt that the services, the salaries for the services in the major departments in Yonkers are the biggest expenditure outside of the Board of Ed. And we have all these, you know, unsettled contracts that become a bigger and bigger liability as time goes on.
And how does it strike your sensibilities, for example, that there were contracts recently being made in New Rochelle and other parts of the county? How do they do it, and how come we're reluctant to move forward and resolve this issue? Because it also creates a tremendous amount of schisms and divides within the city. You know, there's some people, you know, they cry out with a firefighter earning their pay, and yet there are people in government that are making $150,000, $165,000 a year. Nobody seems to bat an eye.
Well, I've said that in discussions with the city. When they talk about our starting salary. And I said, and what about your starting salary?
Yeah.
You know, these people that are sitting across the table from us, and they just walked in to a job making $140,000, $150,000, $160,000. And we're going to complain about what a police officer or a firefighter starting salary is?
Yeah.
Someone that's been working for the city for possibly 10 years, maybe working for the city for another 20 years, is not someone that's temporary. But, you know, well, that's not neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're only concerned about, you know, how can they effectuate some kind of savings, probably so they can bump up their own remuneration.
Mm-hmm.
But it's insulting to, you know, to turn around to a firefighter and say we're going to reduce the firefighter's starting salary, you know, to poverty levels. That's not going to happen. You know,
I just am beside myself because this whole issue of sitting down and working out a contractual agreement. This particular mayor is now in office about 20 months, maybe almost 21 months in a few days. The bottom line is, how are we going to get over this? Because it's causing a tremendous amount of strain internally everywhere. And there's just the city doesn't seem to be gaining any forward movement. And then I don't understand even how we're going to build ourselves out of this situation, because it seems that the burden of even construction and economic development is falling on the backs of the taxpayer. And I think we're exhausted as a taxpayer. I don't know where we're getting the money.
Well, unfortunately, you know, in cities, you know, Scarsdale is a village.
Yeah.
There's almost no commercial activity in Scarsdale, right, with the exception of downtown. They have a few little stores and a jewelry store and a furrier. So they don't expect to derive a lot of revenue from their business activities. Now, a city, on the other hand, because, you know, it is a city and it's a population center, there's generally a business district or business, and you're expected to derive a significant portion of your income, of your revenues, from businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the practice of this city for the last 20 years or so has been to let the businesses pay nothing.
Yeah.
Whether it's Stu Leonard's, Costco, whether it's Ridge Hill, you know, Cross County, now they give them so many pilots and abatements. Everywhere you turn on the waterfront, anytime there's a project, they give a pilot. And it's pennies on the dollar for what they should be paying. And in turn, the service costs to the city are going up. You know, you put a 200-unit apartment building up in Ridge Hill, and there's going to be some children there. They're going to have to go to the schools.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some people there. They're going to have a domestic dispute, and they're going to call the police. There's going to be some people there that are careless cooking, and they're going to have a kitchen fire, and you have to call the fire department. And they all have garbage, and they have to be provided water and sanitation and snow plowing and everything else. So if you're not bringing in the requisite amount of revenue to cover the additional increase in your expenditures, you're going to have a problem. And we've seen that time after time after time. The Yonkers IDA, I know they have a meeting tomorrow. Nobody goes to it, right? They have a meeting. Yeah. It'll be a 30-second meeting. All here, all in favor, yes, yes, yes. Okay, motion to adjourn, and it's over. And the devil's in the details, but we have one of the biggest IDAs in the state. We're as big as the entire county's IDA in the amount of tax breaks that's given out. You know, the tax breaks are not only given out for the property taxes, but they give them sales tax abatements. And they allow them to everything that they purchase, basically to avoid paying sales tax on it. And then they enter into these long-term pilot agreements where they're paying pennies on the dollar. So, you know, that's one of the problems, the long-term problems that Yonkers is facing, and we're feeling the effects now, of the continual, you know, giveaways to everybody that wants to develop. You know, if we were in Syracuse, I could see that. But we're in Yonkers. We're 20 minutes from Grand Central Station. We have two trains that go to Midtown Manhattan, on either side of our city. We are a prime location. We should stop giving away the store. And unfortunately, most of it's been given away, and there's not much left to develop. And even still, the small slivers that are left, like Chicken Island and the waterfront, that'll be given away too.
Yeah.
And who's going to pick up the slack? Poor Mr. and Mrs. Jones that, you know, have lived in the city of Yonkers for 40 years, and now they can't afford to keep their house because the taxes keep going through the roof. You know, we expect in a city to derive significant revenues from the business activity. Yonkers doesn't get it. We get a pittance of the sales tax. You know, sales tax is what, 8.75%?
Yeah.
4% goes to the 4% goes to the state. 4% goes to the county. And Yonkers gets some share of the remaining 0.75%. See, and real income taxes? What are the people that they're hiring at the racetrack? It's great. Oh yeah, we're gonna hire 50 people at the racetrack. They're paying them $9 an hour. Most of them aren't even gonna make enough money to pay income tax.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we need if they're gonna be giving away incentives to create jobs to businesses, it should be for good jobs. So someone who's graduating college maybe and could be making $70,000 or $80,000 a year and can be able to live in the city or the region without being on some type of public assistance themselves.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big picture problem here that's really trickling down to all the municipalities like Yonkers. Unfortunately, Yonkers has just been giving away the store for years, which just makes it even worse.
We should tell people we're speaking with Barry McGoey. He's president of the Yonkers Fire Department. And just we're talking about all kinds of situations. Is there a way out of here, in a sense? I guess we would need to engage ourselves in discussion if that's going to lead somewhere, or maybe just getting some sort of leadership. But it does look to me that government is very reluctant to make a move. It's as if they're waiting for financial circumstances to change and thereby, you know, issues to be resolved and then get kicked another 10 years down the road. there just seems to be an inequity here. And I find it very difficult when I think that unions are needed more than ever. I think unions haven't passed their time. I think, if anything, they've been brought back into need. You know, even though maybe 20 years ago they said, you don't need a union anymore. But I think you do, because the union membership's rights aren't always protected. And yet there are people who are getting protection from government and subsidy from government. And yet the public is reluctant to recognize how many subsidies corporations get. And that's welfare.
Absolutely. We have corporate welfare is probably even a bigger problem than our other welfare, because the people that we provide financial assistance to on the lowest economic levels, those mm-hmm. are for bare essentials to make it through life, to make sure right. a child has food on the table through and a roof over their head through a Section 8 program or WIC mm-hmm. checks. I mean, people can moan and groan, you know, why aren't these people, you know, why aren't they being self-sufficient? But at the end of the day, we're the United States of America is a very good and caring and compassionate society, and we're not going to have a child without a roof over their head or without food on the table or a safe school to go to. So, but it takes money to be compassionate. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about some of these bigger issues, and I'm not the governor and I'm not the mayor, and I can't mm-hmm. solve all these problems. My problems relate directly to the city of Yonkers and more specifically the Yonkers firefighters.
Yeah.
And making sure that, you know, our rights are upheld, that we maintain a decent standard of living, that we have, you know, decent and fair increases as our cost of living increases go up. And unfortunately, to date, I've had no success working with this. We had no success with the last administration, and now this new administration, we don't. Unfortunately, I think the current mayor has taken a lot of bad advice from people, to be quite honest, aren't from the city of Yonkers, don't know the first thing about the city of Yonkers, and yet, you know, they're the ones calling the shots. Now, mm-hmm. when you emailed me last week, you asked me about this PERB list. You know, this E.J. McMahon had put out a list together.
Right.
And had Yonkers was excluded from this list, the Yonkers firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem is because E.J. McMahon submitted a FOIL request to PERB and requested all the declaration of impasses that PERB had received recently. Well, it's obvious that PERB did not was not responsive to his request regarding Yonkers.
No.
He didn't include them. And one of the issues there is because from many, many months ago, we engaged in conversations with the city of Yonkers, all off the record, because we were hoping to get something resolved in a streamlined process. And we went through basically what turned out to be sham negotiations with the city and with their attorneys. And, you know, the city has a Fifth Avenue New York City law firm negotiating it on their behalf with us. And most of the time it's at least two or three of them. So God knows the kind of money they've expended to date trying to, you know, well, making it look like they were trying to negotiate, but in the end didn't negotiate with us. So after we had numerous off-the-record discussions with the city, and almost every one of them, it was articulated at the beginning of the meeting that these were off-the-record discussions,
mm-hmm.
and they weren't fruitful, the city filed a declaration of impasse with PERB, and that was back in February 2013.
Wow.
Now, along with their declaration of impasse, they actually disclosed many of the off-the-record proposals and discussions that were held.
Isn't that illegal?
Yeah, it's an improper legal practice. It's an improper employer practice.
Uh-huh.
One of the things you do, it's kind of like when you're setting a lawsuit. If I was to slip on your sidewalk and we entertain negotiation settlements and you were going to pay me $50,000 to have the lawsuit go away, and then eventually the settlement broke apart, we wouldn't be able to go into a court and to disclose that fact to a jury that you were willing to pay me $50,000,
mm-hmm.
because that would tend to you know, create a bias in the jury.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And in our society, we want things to be settled. We don't want them to be litigated. We don't want them a third party to decide things. So PERB is very, it's a very long precedent that it is an improper practice for either side to disclose off-the-record communications, and it's not even allowable to use those off-the-records in a declaration of impasse.
Oh, my.
So that's why Mr. McMahon's FOIL was not made available, because it does provide the records that were filed with PERB contain very confidential matters which never should have been disclosed outside the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be having a hearing in front of PERB on whether or not that was an improper practice of the city to basically use off-the-record conversations and proposals in a declaration of impasse. So, yes, we should be on that list. Well, we are on the list. This new law does not affect us. The city, either way, even if the governor had not amended his program bills, you'll recall that the first program bill stated that if either party had filed for interest arbitration,
correct,
prior to the enactment of the legislation, it wouldn't apply to them. And
yes,
then they amended it to expand that definition to not only a petition for interest arbitration, but a declaration of impasse. So in Yonkers' case, Yonkers Firefighters, we have both. There's been a declaration of impasse filed by the city and a petition for interest arbitration filed by the city. So there's no doubt that these new provisions immediately apply to Local 628 because of the city's filing of the basically we deemed to be an illegal and improper declaration of impasse, which was then filed with a petition for interest arbitration. And unfortunately, as I said before, you know, that wasn't Mike Spano, the mayor, making a declaration of impasse. He's relying upon advice from so-called legal experts to do these things. And unfortunately, they're not from Yonkers. They don't know how Yonkers operates. They don't know the first thing about Yonkers, and now it looks like they don't know the first thing about labor law. And they've created a situation which has actually made it that much more contentious, because we've had to expend tens of thousands of dollars in legal expenditures on basically defending ourselves from frivolous and unfounded petitions and filings in PERB. And we look forward to, in October, there'll be a hearing in front of PERB for a determination whether or not it was a improper practice to disclose off-the-record proposals and documents in a declaration of impasse. So that's why Mr. McMahon, we weren't included on Mr. McMahon's list. I know it's a long answer.
This is not
kindergarten stuff. We're dealing with some of the most complex labor law issues that are known. And it's a matter of some of the things that the city has done dumbfound our attorney, who has over 30 years of labor law experience, and saying, well, what are they doing?
Hmm.
So,
I was wondering if this situation now quickens the resolution or moving toward a resolution, or is it almost impossible to tell? Could this be stretched out for another 2 years of discussion?
Absolutely.
Really?
No, when you get into legal contentious battles like this, that does nothing to solve the underlying issue. Despite all of these issues and problems, I've tried to reach out to the administration to say, I have a long stake here. Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't just hired here for 2 years to be the commissioner of public affairs, as many people in the administration are. They're temporary placeholders. They become commissioners, deputy commissioners. They're and they're gone in 2 years, and then they're working for the county or for Hillary Clinton or somebody else. I have a long term stake here. I'm a homeowner in the city of Yonkers. I live here. I've lived here for 30-some-odd years, not my whole life, but, the major portion of my adult life. I plan on staying here. I have children here. I'm a firefighter. I'm going to be a firefighter. I'm probably going to be a firefighter for the next 10 years, 15 years, God willing. We have an interest. We have a vested stake in the city of Yonkers, and we don't want the city of Yonkers to go bankrupt. We don't want it to be Detroit or some of these other cities out there. And I'm not just saying to firefighters. That goes for the police officers, the DPW workers, the teachers, everybody. We don't want to have a bankrupt city. But the problem is we never seem to be included in as one of those major stakeholders. And there's probably nobody a bigger stakeholder than some of the employees of a municipality, other than the homeowners and the business owners.
Yes.
But we never seem to be included into giving, you know, given any kind of recognition that, you know, we're going to be here. You know, there's going to be, you know, garbage men in the city of Yonkers 20 years from now. There'll be firefighters and there'll be cops. There'll be different faces, but, you know, we'll be here. So we have a vested interest in.
We can't automate what you do. You know, technology is not going to resolve all those issues. You need
to still is a very, it's a very difficult city to provide all of those services to because of the topography and dealing with, you know, 45-degree grades in the wintertime with fire apparatus and police apparatus and ambulances and, you know, and plow trucks and garbage trucks and school buses. This is not an easy city to actually operate.
No.
And it's a city that needs a lot of services. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we can still try to get things resolved. But if the game is going to be – if it's going to be a big game for people that seem to be advising the mayor so that they can extract as many hours of billable hours as they possibly can but get nowhere, I mean, we've literally got nowhere in a year and a half.
I know that.
If anything, we're farther away than we ever were.
And, that's how
but
I
yet,
feel, too.
Yet consultants and attorneys have made hundreds of thousands of dollars on that. And they're almost like divorce lawyers. They don't want to get resolved because you can take all the marital assets and divvy it up between the attorneys and the accountants. Now, that looks like what's happening here with the city.
Unbelievable. Very frightening situations. But that's where we are. I guess it's very, very good of you to just share all that because I think it places us on a different level of comprehension of what's going on. It does seem as though we're lacking a vision in how to resolve these issues. And like you said, you're there to represent the fire department to the best of your ability. You're not the mayor. You're not the city council membership. You know, it's really up to them. And I don't know if they have the wherewithal to get it done.
Thank God we have you that are out there with some of these stories because, you know, News 12 doesn't seem to be interested. The newspaper, the Journal News, doesn't seem to be interested. And they just want to cover, you know, oh, there's a ribbon cutting at the new 99-cent store or there's a new movie theater opening up. That's great. That's basically going to provide no revenue to the city. It's not going to really do anything. And, you know, you can have all these great press releases you want that's going to attract new visitors to the city. Yeah, they'll come and they leave and spend as little amount as possible. That's not going to help us. We need to sit down and come up with a real plan of how we're going to have economic development that's going to actually improve the city's economy and not just improve the bank accounts of developers and the giveaways of parklands. I mean, you know, there's a million stories, I'm sure you know more than me, of all the breaks and giveaways and shenanigans that have taken place with 108 loans and everything else for decades. And that's one of the reasons why we're in the hole that we're in. And we'd like to crawl out of that hole as much as anybody else. But it's not going to be done on our backs and our backs alone.
Well, I think that's really that's a very powerful statement because it can't be done on your backs, nor should it have ever been considered to be on your back. And I wonder if the attitude of the city and the attitude of our elected officials will change or if it will just like they'll dig their heels in and stick to it on their end. But then that means you'll have to stick to it on your end because there is no winning here. Not if it's on the back of the union membership who haven't gotten a contract for 5 years. It just makes no sense at all. And then I still wonder, like, why we're not getting any kickback or give back by the administration. I still see them hiring, and I still see the amount of money that they pay their staff going through the roof. And I don't understand why that's acceptable. Hold on one split second, because we have a caller. Good morning, caller.
Desi, it's John for the next...
Hi. Bear with me a moment. I'll leave you on hold so you could listen in and as we finish with Barry McGowey, the president of the YFD. So what do you think, Barry? Where do we stand now? Are we just at a standstill waiting for what's going to happen in October?
Well, no. I mean, we're still open to sitting down and trying to have a dialogue, trying to have some type of resolution to this current quagmire that we seem to find ourselves in.
Right.
The mud seems to get thicker and deeper in so many ways as we go farther and farther along this process. So if we could come to some kind of resolution, that ultimately is my number one goal. I'd much rather be, watching, spending my weekend watching my kids play in the sprinkler than going up to Albany and having meetings and poring over legal documents. That
absolutely
ultimately is our best goal. Our firefighters would love to focus on, training for the next emergency, responding to fires and medical emergencies, instead of talking about, how they're going to be able to pay the rent next month because they haven't had a raise in 4 years, but their rent has gone up, 20% in the last 4 years. So
yes.
There are a lot of issues, and we'd much rather try to get them resolved amicably and within the city of Yonkers as opposed to having, outside influences, whether that be, the Ravitch and Brodsky's or the control board or bankruptcy or wherever. But something's going to have to give, and I can just tell you we'll be taking it to the electorate as time goes on. We're going to be engaged in quite extensive voter education efforts going forward because, we just don't see that the media has any interest in pointing out some of the causes of the turmoil here in the city of Yonkers, and we're just tired of it being laid at our feet and us being blamed for all the ills of the city of Yonkers, and specifically the Yonkers firefighters, because it's like we've been targeted. I don't see any virtual or issues with, and not that I want to see other unions attacked or other professions attacked, but everything seems to be against us.
Well, it does seem to be just that way, and you have been targeted, and it's not difficult to see. It isn't even veiled anymore. It used to be veiled.
Right.
Well, anyway, I want to thank you, Barry McGoey, president of the Yonkers Fire Department, president of the Local 628 of the International Association of Firefighters. Thanks for bringing us up to speed. It's been many, many months since we last spoke, so it's really, really good. Thank you.
And thank you for having me, and I look forward to listening to the rest of your broadcast with Mr. McMullen, is it right?
Absolutely.
Look forward to that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Bye. All right, that's Barry McGoey, president of the Yonkers Fire Department, IAFF Local 628. And we're going to be speaking in a moment with John McMullen, who's ready on the line. And before we do that, let's find out what's going on at the Westchester Broadway Theater just to see what they're doing. So listen in.
It's one of the most celebrated musicals of all time, with an unforgettable score by the world's most famous songwriting team. And it's on stage now at the Westchester Broadway Theater through August the 11th. Rodgers and Hammerstein's incomparable The Sound of Music. It's the classic story of Maria, the young governess who brings her love of music to the Von Trapp family amidst the intrigue of pre-war Europe. This uplifting story is the perfect musical for the entire family this summer, and its irresistible score includes some of Broadway's most memorable hits like My Favorite Things, Edelweiss, Do Re Mi, Climb Every Mountain, and many more. And remember, before the show, you and your family will enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of 6 entrees with special prices for the kids. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Now's the time to rediscover Broadway right in your own backyard. This summer, bring the entire family to experience one of the world's best-loved musicals, Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, now through August the 11th, only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level. My name is Cezzy Harris, and we have John F. McMullen on the line. Good morning, John.
Hi, good morning, Hezzy. How are you this morning?
Oh, really okay. It's so good to speak to you, and it's so funny. I think we'll have more time to speak to one another in this venue than we've ever had before, even though we've shared a couple of lunches now and then. So I thank you for making the time. Well, we should tell people that John McMullen is not only an author, he's a poet, he's a writer. He also writes for the Westchester Guardian, and thank goodness on a frequent basis. And I think the first thing that got me attracted to John's work was his Creative Disruption column, which at first I said, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for, because you evidently spoke to me in a way that was a little bit more than simple, yet not so far removed from my ability to comprehend, not all, but most of the stuff that you wrote about when it comes to technology and how it does disrupt our societal standards. How did you stay abreast of all these technological changes? But more importantly, when did you give yourself the time to really think and assess what was going on with technology, society, standards, and behavior patterns?
Well, I've been in the business for a long time, and I've put systems in both for governments and for mainly Wall Street firms that made changes not only to their efficiency, but also meant that they had either could do more work with the same number of people, or they were doing equal work with less people. So the disruption, it was slower then, and it was also that in many cases there were new jobs created, if not on a one-for-one basis, but close to it. But as technology accelerated, and I was more and more doing consulting and teaching and had to keep up with this, it was evident that there were massive changes that were happening, not only in manufacturing with robotics and everything, but in office work and everything. For instance, things that we tend not to think about if they don't affect us directly or people that we know. For instance, every bill that we pay online means that there are no longer people, normally older people, opening envelopes at Con Edison or at the telephone company. There is no one keying in payments. There is no one tabulating checks to make bank deposits. And in many cases, those people are too old or too uneducated to be retrained for the higher jobs, of which there are fewer anyhow. And then all of a sudden, you look around and Tower Records is gone, or Borders is gone, or there is no longer a film development store in the mall. And it becomes evident that there are the massive changes going on. The current issue of the Futurist magazine talks about disappearing futures, that smartphones are going to go away and be replaced just by voice-activated things, that there will be 2 billion jobs lost by 2030. And there will be new jobs, but very often not of the number that we're replacing.
That's really what's so frightening about it all, because we are going through that transitional stage, the transformation from the past industrial revolution to a new future, as you said, and populations are growing, and availability of funds are less and less, and we can't train people fast enough to keep up with the latest technology, and I don't know, I'm starting to feel almost like an old man, because I'm not as adept as these 5-year-old kids, and even the instructions for learning how to use this equipment, I think, is geared for 5-year-olds, because they get it, and I don't.
Well,
I don't know what's wrong with me.
One of the brightest people in this field, a fellow named Alan Kay, was quoted saying that technology is something that was invented after I was born. If you grow up with something, you get it. When we started consulting, we made lots of money teaching people how to use spreadsheets and how to use word processing. Now grammar school kids do that because they grew up computers in the house. You know, so everything is changing. And in the Industrial Revolution, in many cases, the job replacement was the one-for-one. People, blacksmiths, went in to work for General Motors and things like this. Now, the technology is replacing the individual worker, and we have to think about that. We have to plan for it, and we're not.
Yeah, that's what it is. I guess we're also losing sight of the issues, and our ability to plan, because it seems that there's always something new and something very exciting. It's very mesmerizing, very sexy to find out the latest gizmo from Apple. And then I just learned only yesterday that there were photos of their new 5 or the 5S, phone that's supposed to be coming out. And it just goes on and on. So we never have that discussion. I wonder, though, also if the input of big firms like Google and Apple in government and their input is guiding us not necessarily in the right direction.
That's possible, Hezzy. I think more and more, well, number one, Apple and Google and Microsoft and General Motors and the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry and unions all have too much money involvement in government. I think we all know that.
Yeah.
And I don't see a way around that. We also have, because of our dysfunction in national government and the fact that we're so polarized, there's little interest in long-range planning. Everything is, what happens next week? Will there be a government shutdown? Will we extend the debt limit? These are all things in the near future. You never hear anyone talk about what do we do when this industry goes away? To what do we do when Rochester or Detroit are disseminated by technology? What is our plan? And we have none.
Absolutely. And that's what's most scary, is that we fall into this pattern of diminishing returns because we don't have a discussion. And somehow we need that discussion, I think, to be able to get a better sense of where we're heading. So besides your input and understanding and appreciation of the disruption into technology, how do you also find the time with all of this contemplation and deciphering and distilling what's going on? How do you get the time to read all the books that you read and write your own books and sit down and take the time to write poetry as well? What do you satisfy with that aspect of your nature?
Well, number one, I sleep very little. But
okay.
Aside from that, I'm an English major going bad. I was an English major at Iona College back when Abraham Lincoln was president. And I very rapidly, through luck, moved into technology. I had never seen a computer before I began working with one for the federal government. And that went on for a long time. But our early interest in microcomputers, that was also through being in the right place at the right time while we were with Morgan Stanley, led a magazine to ask Barbara McMullen to write about spreadsheets, which he did, and I edited, and from then on we wrote together for a long time. Then she moved more and more into full-time education. I concentrated on writing while I teach as an adjunct. I hadn't read a poem since I graduated from college till I came across one in Barnes & Noble that caught my eye by Charles Bukowski, and then I started reading some, and then the line caught my eye, and I wrote a poem called Cashing a Check that I submitted on someone's advice to a contest, and it probably ruined my life because I won fourth prize in the contest, and I started writing more and more. Then now I have a book on Amazon of 110 poems, you know. So it keeps me busy.
Absolutely, it must. How do you get your mind to function on the level of poetry? How do you create that conciseness and that that message that comes across in a sentence or in a line, a stanza or two? I've always wanted to, they say brevity is most important, and you get that in poetry. I sometimes found myself overloading the words to such an extent that even I got confused by the time I finished the stanza.
Well, I call myself a poet, that other people do, but I don't write much flowery stuff. I tend to write things that end in sarcasm or sardonic lines fairly humorous. So what I do is all of a sudden something will strike me, and I'll go write it down. And eventually then I'll read it at the Hudson Valley Writers' Center, which is a terrific place down in Sleepy Hollow. And eventually I'll put together a book or the chapbook, or I'll publish it as part of an article in The Guardian or something like that.
Very, very interesting. And speaking of the articles, like I know that you got an award from Iona for your Creative Disruption series. And how did that come about?
I don't have the foggiest idea. I didn't even know that.
Well, you know, I'm very simple-minded that way, too. You know, I just feel that I'm not smart enough to guide myself through life, and that evidently there's somebody watching over me.
Oh, do you know what I think you're referring to? They asked me to speak at two of their international conferences, I did.
Well, and that's how you eventually got recognized, eventually.
Yeah.
That's terrific. I think that's terrific. That must have been a wonderful feeling to be able to recognize that you've actually connected with people through your writing.
Yes, it is. Well, I've been writing for years, and I published in all sorts of magazines. So, you know, I'm used to that. And I write for two reasons. In my prose, it's I want other people to understand what I do and what I understand. And the more that I have to write, the more I have to research and I learn more. Poetry is really helping me understand what I feel. My prose, I want people to be able to read it and to appreciate it. I would like them to do that with my poetry, but quite frankly, I really don't care if they do because I write it for me.
Yeah. That's interesting. So what books have you already published, and can people get it at Amazon and other books?
In the 1980s, Barbara and I wrote one of the first book on microcomputer communications. And it took John Wiley forever to get it out. They weren't used to having to turn things around very rapidly. And by the time it came out, it was out of date. We contributed to a wonderful book that was way ahead of its time in 1984 called Digital Delhi. And some of the other writers were Henny Youngman, William F. Buckley, John D. MacDonald, the mystery writer, Ray Bradbury. And then for a long time, it was magazine articles. Now, I have a bunch of books up on Amazon, but the only two that I really recommend is the new and collected poems by John Mack, the Bard, that's me, and also the Inwood book, which is set in my old neighborhood at the northern tip of Manhattan Island, and it contains a novella and some short stories and some poetry about the neighborhood. And I'm presently doing the book called Tales of Inwood, that's the memoir of growing up in the 50s and the 60s, when Inwood was the biggest bar neighborhood in New York City. Walter Winchell called it Ginwood. It was an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood. And the character of the neighborhood changed, or the ethnicity, but it's still the same kind of neighborhood. It's by the only forest in New York City, Inwood Hill Park. It's by Baker Field, where Columbia has their football stadium. And it's a terrific place, but I'm trying to capture of the spirit and the times of the 1950s and the 1960s there.
Well, it's so interesting that you mention Inwood, and you mentioned that really, in a sense, it's the same type of neighborhood. And when I heard you say that, I realized that, yes, you're right. And it's just the ethnicities that may have changed. But the feel and the vibrancy is still there. It's a very, very, it's a hotbed of activity. And it somehow has been able to weather the storm of change. And there's that community spirit and the bars that are there, a sense of something going on, and shopping late into the night and streets lit up and lighted. And then you've got, like you said, the park and the Hudson River, and it's just wonderful. And that's a fantastic undertaking to be able to bring that to life.
I was down there over the weekend, and they had this, you can get rowboats down there. I'm sorry, canoes for nothing on the lagoon. And I did a poetry reading at the local drugstore that's just like an old-time drugstore that has the soda fountain. They have ice cream. They've got coffee and cake.
Yes.
And it's in a place that the corner of 27th Street and Broadway burned down a year ago, January. This is in its place. It's the same drugstore that was there before that's come back, and it's bigger, and it's trying to be almost a community center.
It's really terrific. Really very, 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 very nice, actually. You could see the pain of their transformation, but you could also see it coming back to life. It was like on an ICU unit for maybe a while, but it certainly was able to find its place. And I think the underpinning of it all has been the great involvement of the Irish community. That was really the biggest standard. It's the baseline that kept the community together. Would you agree?
To an extent, I think that the Catholic Church there, Good Shepherd, had always been the center of the neighborhood, and they were able to bring together the traditional Irish Catholic group with the newer Dominicans, and
yes.
they had priests who spoke Spanish, and I participated in a post 9/11 a candlelight vigil down there, carrying flags through the neighborhood and everything, and there was 1,000 people in the church. And there were priests speaking in both languages. There was the Jewish assemblyman, Stanley Michael, who was talking about that the Good Shepherd has always been the center of the community, no matter what religion you were. And it seemed to work. So
it certainly did. Absolutely, the churches really kept it together. Well, you find that the churches do keep communities together because so much revolves about the church. And those churches that have been able to evolve as their communities changed have been able to maintain that hold and the cohesiveness that a community requires. Are you also very, very interested in religion that way?
I'm interested in it. Number one, in the, so much it can do to bring us together, but also that so many different faiths push us apart, and we've seen over the years bigotry in faiths, whether it was mainly racial. Now we see faith versus faith with in many cases the Islamic prejudice, and also with real fears of the fundamental Islamists, and it concerns me.
And it does seem that in a sense the fervor and the different schisms within Islam has certainly seemed to infuse a sense or a need even for the other religions to become more fervent and more fanatical as well. So you see a reverberation throughout the world. It's a very interesting change. In Judaism, there you've got fundamentalists and or the regular guys, and I think you find that in Christianity as well. And you also find this tremendous animosity between Islam and Christianity that even exceeds that of Islam against Judaism.
Do you think so? We normally hear the anti-Jewish rhetoric from the extremists. I don't hear quite as much anti-Christian.
I think that's because media has not been correct about it. Of course, there's an anti-Jewish, but it happens to be an anti-Israel sentiment more than I think an anti-Jewish sentiment. It's like inconsequential, but there's a great deal of there's like a minority of Egyptian Copts. These are Christians,
right?
And also in Syria and Lebanon, and they're being slaughtered. And the world is really not looking very hard at it. And then you also have the divide in certain parts of Africa, like in Nigeria, between, fundamentalists on the Islamic side and Christians on the other side.
Right.
So you're having a tremendous amount of pain, but it hasn't seemed to come to the forefront. It's certainly not part of the mainstream discussion. And,
well, the other thing that people have pointed out is that the Christianity had the Reformation and Judaism had the movement to reform and conservatives, where there has never been anything like that in the Islamic world. So it's we've had people who become more moderate, but there's never been movements to modernize Islam. And I don't know whether there will be.
Well, actually, there is, because you see the divide between the Shia and the Sunni and the Ismailis and so on. So,
but that goes back hundreds of years, though. The Shiites and Sunnis broke apart, certainly somewhat after Muhammad died. There hasn't been anything since, really.
No, you're right. You're right. It's going to be interesting to see if these different sects explode or somehow find accommodation. It'll be very interesting. Well, I too find religion extremely interesting, and how the different religions interact and the similarities amongst them is really what makes me most interested in it, rather than the disparity between them, and also the traditions of each of the religions, certainly between Christianity and Islam and Judaism. To me, they're almost like kindred spirits. So there's a lot that you could see that's there.
And well, they all traced their roots, or the three of those, back to Abraham, anyhow.
Yeah,
and that was also part of Inwood. Inwood, when I grew up, was an Irish Catholic Jewish neighborhood. There were very few Italians. There were very few Protestants. It was homogeneous with those two people. You know.
Yes.
Period.
That's so true. And yet, and there's so many people that still, you know, it was like a birthplace, actually. Inwood actually was the place from which many people in Yonkers came to, and they moved even further into Westchester. So you have a lot of people from all over Inwood just making Westchester their home.
Sure. There's the many of the Irish went up to the Woodlawn section, both in Yonkers and in and the Bronx. Many of the Jewish people and me went to Riverdale.
Yeah. It's just really, really, really fascinating. It's interesting how we see each other moving about. So, what else excites you about the? Well, are you? You must be very comfortable with the writing, which is evident by reading your column in the Westchester Guardian as one example, and your work. Do you find that very satisfying? Because I find for me writing allows me to grow mentally, and also to keep my whatever. If I am sharp, at least it keeps me on a certain level, which I think
I do find it very satisfying, and I find it very, very satisfying when people talk about it. Sometimes, like the most recent article on Detroit, it was very intense and took research, and I found that tiring but rewarding. Normally, my writing is exhilarating. I also have the benefit of Barbara McMullen editing every column, because I have written 1,500, 1,700 articles, books, and I can't type. I'm the worst typist in the world, and that leads to misspellings and everything. And she's terrific in picking things up. So I'm very, very lucky, and she fits that into her schedule, which is teaching at three colleges and teaching online and being the mainstay here with our house and with our pets. So.
Well, that's what I want to ask you, too, because you're so aware of the technology. Does it look like we're going to be able to create a school through the internet? Are we going to do that?
We already have. Now, I have some concerns. I've taught online, and I've teach in classrooms. And the online work, people who aren't around it, they don't realize that it requires much more work from a teacher, because you have to give much more material. In the classroom, I can tell if some students aren't getting it, and I can alter things on the fly. Online, unless you're completely interactive, and most programs aren't, and they shouldn't be, you can tell. So you have to do two things. You have to give a lot of work. Then you have to constantly assess. That means more quizzes,
yeah,
more assignments, more whatever. So it's different. And to be an online student, you have to have discipline. You have to keep up with the work. You can't say, well, I have the weekend, and then you go out on the weekend. It's a change. Now, are we going to be able to do this? Sure. But we're going to have to get faculty that's committed, and we're also going to have to get students who are mature. Now, there are some terrific programs now. There's an outfit called Coursera, C-O-U-R-S-E-R-A, and they started out providing courses from colleges all over, from Michigan, from Stanford, from all over, online, completely free. They've recently entered into partnership with the State University of New York to provide courseware to the state universities, to the campuses. Now, that's still not quite clear how it's going to work, because the faculty are concerned about this. Does that mean that they'll be replaced, or there'll be less courses, or they'll have a chance to participate? And all of the talk from the top level has been very positive. No, this is to enhance the ability for the students and everything. Now Barbara McMullen was the dean of online education at Monroe College, and she's deployed courses. She also did that at Marist, deployed courses for a government program, and that worked out very well. But once again, you have to ensure that the students are prepared, that they have access to technology, and that they're mature. Then you have to ensure that the faculty is going to put the time in. Barbara's given two courses for purchase during the summer online that have taken a 15-week semester, put it into 3 weeks, so you've made every day in the class equal to a week in the in-class. And it takes tremendous dedication by the students to keep up with this.
And also a tremendous mind of the teacher to keep it going and keeping it alive.
Oh, yeah. And to mark things every day to be sure that the students have feedback and they know where they stand. Absolutely.
Yeah. It looks as there's promise for it, but I wonder, it will be a major, major disheveling of the whole process. And it may lose a great deal of faculty, wouldn't it? Because I guess once you have an exceptional course online, you can repeat it over and over and over again, almost as if you were conducting a particular course in algebra or in English.
It would depend on the course, but some things you have to keep current. Like I have to tweak my course on SUNY Purchase that I give every year, because I have the students responding to newspaper articles, to posting things, and to then trying to explain how the statistics or the charts either benefit or confuse the reader. Now, obviously, I have to keep that updated, and I also have to be able to present new ways of displaying things, because things, they're constantly improving. There are some courses I'm sure that could be repetitive, but you would still need teachers to do the grading, to do the advising. Now, one of the problems is that some schools have thought that you can handle more students because it's online and you're not limited by the classroom. But you're putting a tremendous demand on the teachers who are already going to have to do more work for these online courses. So it's something that has to be worked through, but a lot of people see this as the way that we have to go, particularly in training, that we're going to have people taking courses on their own time to learn new technologies, to learn new ways of doing things, and to learn new careers. Because from now on, the most important skill that someone has to have is be able
to adapt because things constantly change. Jobs that were once very high-paying jobs disappear. Can you imagine being a vice president of chemical engineering at Kodak, making $1,000 a year and all of a sudden gone? You know,
yeah.
And so people have to always be learning their own job to do it better, but have to be looking over their shoulder to what's coming next and preparing for that. So we are putting more and more demands on the individual worker. There's less and less leisure time because you always have to stay ahead of the curve. And that's scary to a lot of people.
Well, I think it can be very scary. I never thought about the back end of teaching when it comes to online, the online dissemination of educational material. I never realized all the work and the extra work that's required of it, so that you might have a standardized course, but then you need a whole slew of teachers to keep up with whether the student population is getting it. Fascinating.
The thing you also have to bring into this is in the classroom. What I teach at SUNY Purchase, there are many of the students, they're arts management or they're musicians, but there's also biologists and there's also psychology majors. And you have to be able to assess your class and tailor your presentations to the class. In other words, if there's a very sharp class, you don't want to put them to sleep. If there are people that need additional help, you want to be able to provide that to them. And then that's hard to do online because you don't make the eye contact. And have them standing up to make presentations and to find out if they're articulate, if they can string together two ideas. So the idea is that you really have to work at developing that interpersonal relationship with students who are 1,000 miles away. And you have to be able to do that to do an effective job.
I never thought of that. So why did you mention before that you thought it would be inappropriate to have an interactive, let's say, video or viewing of your classroom? Or is that not what you said? I mean, is it possible, for example, to have a classroom
with
50 people and look at them?
There are ways to do that, and normally you would structure an online course so periodically during the semester that you would have chat rooms or group meetings or coming together. That's fine. But if you just make it what they call the sage on the stage with me talking to a whole bunch of people who are watching me, I'm not going to get the interaction, and I'm not going to get the same interaction that I do when they have to sit down and compose their thoughts and send me homework and messages. The best way is to mix the metaphors, to do them both.
Mm-hmm. So is, in a sense, are we really is this like a new type of paradigm so that we can, let's say, incorporate someone who might be interested in a particular discipline, who may be in India or in Tibet or in Syria or in Bulgaria, and then we can bring them all together because they all speak English. And this way we can reach out to people that normally wouldn't be able to attend a university. But
sure, if they have the internet connection. Now, in many of the places you're talking about, they do not have high-speed internet connection, and that's one of the things that things like the $100 the laptops in Africa and everything are trying to bring to the people. Now, it's interesting. China has really jumped ahead. Many of the areas in China that did not have landlines because it was too expensive to lay wire, They're all on cell now. We have to do the same thing with Africa and with the Mideast. Obviously, with the Mideast too, there's another plus that if you can bring more and more people into the culture and see that the Westerners aren't all devils, that can only help world relations. I mean, I find it hard to believe that supposedly 70% at some time of people on the ground in the Mideast believe that 3,000 Jewish people were called the night before 9/11 and sent home. And these people believe this. Now, if you knew anything about technology, that you would know there is no Jewish central place in the United States that has the phone numbers of everyone who happens to be Jewish who works in the country to call them up. I mean, that's unbelievable. But supposedly people believe that because they're not exposed to the technology or the systems. They can only help to bring people together.
Yeah. What about this whole concept of trying to get every child, and even in America, with those $100 computer units? Basically, I see that items like Google Chrome, they have a Chrome desktop, or laptop, rather. And
I have their laptop. It's a terrific thing. It's $175,229 at the low end. The $175 one is from Acer. The $229 is from Samsung. And what they do is they are very lightweight laptops. They require you to be at some place that has wireless, whether it's your home, Barnes & Noble, Panera's, wherever. And all of the work is done up in the cloud. So you're using all of the various Google apps and things like this, but you want storing things on your computer. It's another way to bring technology to people that do not have technology or people who are on the move who want to be able to use them. I use my Chromebook at Barnes & Noble, and I do the whole lot of writing there, both because I'm not distracted by my dog or my cats or by things in the house, and then I come home. I've down on the Macintosh. I download what I've written, do the finishing touches, do the editing, and turn it over to Barbara for editing, and then I send it off to you.
That's really unbelievable. I was seriously thinking about that. Is the unit also very light?
It's extremely light. It's lighter than any laptop I have. It's lighter than your MacBook.
Oh, because the MacBook is getting heavy for me. I guess I'm getting older, and I find that it's really a strain. Because then I'll have to look into that, because maybe that's the way to go. Because I'm looking for something lighter.
I also use at times, depending what I'm doing, I'll use an iPad with a keyboard, But for serious writing, I find the Chromebook better. Then I'll be glad to help you set it up or do whatever with it.
All right, that'll be really cool because basically I'm a Mac guy, and so this will be out of that realm. But then for word processing, it doesn't make a difference.
No, what they have is, number one, Microsoft has a free cloud service called SkyDrive. And with SkyDrive comes their version of Word on the web. You can do most things. Your spell check is not there and some other things aren't there. But when you get – but then you download it to Word on your Macintosh and you do the spell check and then the editing and away you go. And it's free, the SkyDrive.
That's really terrific. Very, very good. Wow. So, you know, when you were growing up, did you think that you would be so heavily involved in this? What was your initial intent for your life, or did you just allow life to carry you forward? Because I have a sense that I was a little bit nebulous about where I was going, and life dragged me all over the place. And I've been happy about that.
There's the quote from that great philosopher L.P. Berra.
Yeah.
When you come to the fork in the road, take it. L.P. Berra is Yogi Berra, by the way. And the idea is I have been in the right place at the right time. I started out at Iona as a philosophy major, and then I noticed that there weren't many jobs in New York Times for philosophers, so I switched to something much more practical, English literature. I had planned to go to law school, not because I wanted to practice law, because I was interested in law. I wasn't quite sure exactly what I was going to do. Now, a fellow asked me in my senior year at Iona, are you going to take the government test? And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't work for the government. And he said, no, you ought to take it, something to fall back on. And besides, you can drive me up to school. So I said, okay. So I happened to be out very late the night before, and if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have gone. But it turned out that I did very well on this government test. And then I started working at it for an insurance company that was paying my law school tuition, so I was happy with that. But the job was very boring, and I found some of the introductory law courses boring. And then I kept getting these requests from the government that I want to be a border guard or that I want to be an IRS auditor, and I didn't know anything about auditing. And finally, I got something from the Department of Defense saying that there was a pilot program the Department of the Army was doing, and that they was they had looked at 20,000, 200,000, some large amount of resumes, and they were going to interview 200 people for the first four jobs. It was an executive training program, and it just caught my attention, and I was also tired of what I was doing, and I went out, and I was lucky enough to be one of the four selected. And I had 6 months to walk around this transportation installation to look at all the different areas where they got a feel for me. And then they asked me what I would like to do. And I chose the data processing area, what they call it at that time, because the smartest people that I met were in that area.
Yeah.
And I wound up then getting into something that I was really crazy about, designing systems. I later went to a Wall Street firm, and I was able to work my way up to be in charge of their data processing, the Dean Wirin Company.
Yeah.
Then I went with another person, a former Dean Wooden employee who had formed his own consulting firm, and I went with him, and then we sold ourselves to Control Data, and I eventually left them to go to one of our clients, to Morgan Stanley, and then while at Morgan Stanley, my wife and I were going to form our own consulting firm, and we had planned to concentrate on what we knew best, which was large computer systems for brokerage firms. And I was standing by the elevator to go to lunch, and the fellow came up to me and said, "I understand you're leaving." I said, "Yeah, we're going to form our own business." He said, "Have you seen the computer on Ben Rosen's desk?" And I said, "What do you mean a computer on Ben Rosen's desk?" He said, "You ought to go up and take a look at it." So we went up to the to another floor where Ben Rosen, who was the electronics analyst for Morgan Stanley, had an Apple II on his desk. Now, this was before there were any spreadsheets or anything. Then I said, "Gee, I ought to get one of those just to fool around with." Well, I did, and then 6 months later, the first spreadsheet came out. Now, everyone knows spreadsheets now, but in the old days, there were no such things on any computer system, no matter how powerful, as spreadsheets. People had to sit down and to do columns and rows and to put numbers in and add and multiply and do all sorts of calculations. And then if someone said, "I think the interest rate's wrong, you base this on. It shouldn't be 5 1/4. It should be 5 3/4. You go back to drawing board and you do it all over." So we were able to...
I remember those days because I used to do that.
So we were able to get very early into that and begin training people for Wall Street firms and for banks and other firms and using these. And then we got into writing because of that. And I've always been kind of an evangelist, as you can probably tell. And as soon as I knew something, I wanted other people to know it. So I wound up as the president of the local computer club, the Apple Computer Club in New York. And then there was a person who was in the club that was the director of a program at NYU, and he asked to teach. So we taught at NYU. And then the new school was opening a computer center. So we wound up teaching there. And then we wanted to do something closer to home, and we were at Marist College off and on for 20 years. I taught there as an adjunct, and I was a consultant to the president, and Barbara was both an adjunct, and then she ran a one government center. Then she went off to Tufts University for a year and a half, and then back to Marist. And then I did consulting during that time, and I adjuncted. And eventually I went back to Wall Street for a year. The fellow who I'd been in business with before had the new firm. And then I went back into education, and I was a full-time professor at Monroe College in the Bronx with some courses in New Rochelle for 12 years. And then I went back full-time into writing and part-time into teaching. But I was in the right place for the government job. I was in the right place meeting this guy at the elevator. So it was just me being there and being lucky enough to take the path, the fork to the left instead of the fork to the right, you know?
Yeah. Just beautiful. That's a beautiful story. I'll be honest with you. I've always been thankful when I always used to think back of, I don't know how we bumped into one another, but I'm thankful that we did, because it just works out nice. It's really an honor to have gotten to know you, even though we're not always on a eating lunch and stuff like that. But it's always just good to know that you're there. I like your sensibility.
And you, Hezzy, and the same with you, Perry.
Thanks so much. Well, I want to thank you for making the time. I hope we do this again, because I think there's just so much more to discuss and so much more to learn about each other. And then maybe if people learn about you and me a little bit, then we can get to know them a little bit as well and use the technology so it's not as disruptive as it can be, and just be a little bit more, personal, which I think it can be.
I agree.
So, cool. Listen, thanks very much. I want to close the last 15 minutes. We have to do a commercial, and then we also have to tell people what's happening tomorrow. So thank you again. Oh, before you go, though, is there anything that you think that we should have discussed that we didn't? Because there is time for that.
Well, no. It's just that that my main message relating to technology is people have to be open to adapting, because things that are high paying today may not be around tomorrow. Something new that we find out about that interests us is always worth us pursuing.
Well, you know, that's very interesting too, because I think that when I was younger, maybe I wasn't as open as I should have been. I guess I was so insecure that I felt that whatever I was, whatever embellished my makeup, I had to hold on to. But then I realized as I got a little bit older that, no, there were other points of view and other perspectives, and that I needed to just ingratiate them into my thinking. And then I find that being more open and less uncomfortable about being challenged makes it easier. And I think that all-inclusiveness helps.
Let me add one other thing. To do this, what I've done is also – fairly recently, I've set up a comprehensive website that ties to all my writings. It's www.johnmack13.com. And I've also recently begun the podcast, the series of podcasts, or whatever I'm interested in at the moment. And you can get to that through my website also.
Oh, so the link to the podcasts are there? That's very exciting.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that I'll have the link to this, and I will link this from my site also.
Oh, that'll be terrific. Yes, you can, because there is an archive that's kept, and then I'll send you the link as well later on.
Terrific.
That's really great. So thank you again, and let's do this again more often. It's fun.
Hey, thank you, Hezzy. Have a good day.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir. Bye. John F. McMullen, great guy. And if you want to send him an email, you can reach him at johnmack13, so johnmack13@gmail.com. And check out that website that pulls it all together, johnmack13.com, and listen to his podcasts. To be honest, I learned only about the podcast a few days ago, and I thought I'd have time this weekend, but didn't. But I'll be listening to John Mack. He's really, really a fun guy. It was always good to have met him. Well, okay, so that's a story there. And want to quickly point out what's been happening at this end, particularly with tomorrow's schedule. You might want to know that tomorrow, around 10 o'clock or so, within 5 minutes of 10 or so, the Senate leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins, will join us in the morning at 10 o'clock. And what we'll be doing is we'll be speaking to her about the issues that are so pertinent in her face right now as we approach the election season and stuff like that. This is not the year when the senators, the New York State senators, run for re-election. I think that comes on 2 years from now. I think, I'm not even sure, but certainly this is not her year for re-election, and no, it's got to be next year if it's not this year. And so we'll talk about those issues there and what the issues that confront the state and her part in it. She's one of the top people in the leadership of the Democratic contingency there. And we'll see if there will be a continuing divide with the IDC, the Independent Democratic Committee, headed by Jeffrey Klein, and where he shares the leadership with Dean Skelos. So we'll see where that goes, and we'll talk about whatever other issues there are. I think one of the biggest concerns will be about health and medicine and the hospital systems and the input from Albany, if any. So tune in for that. I don't know if we'll how long the conversation will be. Usually about 30 minutes or so, and then we'll follow up on some of the issues that the senator leads us toward. And then what we'll do is we'll probably be going into an analysis of what's happening in the Middle East, and only because on Thursday, where we normally would have the program because we're on every weekday, I'm not going to be available at all, be in a court, listening to a court case, and so I won't be available on Thursday. And then on Friday, though, we'll be coming back, and we'll be speaking to Westchester County Board Legislator Sheila Marcotte, and we'll be speaking to her at 10 o'clock in the morning. So we have a lot to cover, and I just am so appreciative that you listen into us. Let's find out what's going on at the Westchester Broadway Theater, and this is particularly with regard to their sizzling Saturdays. Not this Saturday, but the Saturday after.
The summer excitement is back at the Westchester Broadway Theater with our sizzling Saturday Night Special Series all through August, beginning on Saturday, August 10th, with the incredible Frankie Valli tribute, Let's Hang On. All the greatest hits of the four seasons like Sherry, Walk Like a Man, Big Girls Don't Cry, and so many more. Then on Saturday, August 17th, international singing and recording star Michael Amante returns with his amazing repertoire of romantic, classical, and Broadway hits. Then there's another great oldies and doo-wop night on the 24th with a double bill performance by the Teenagers and the Capris. And we'll finish the series with a hilarious adults-only Battle of the Sexes comedy night on Saturday, August 31st. And don't forget, before each of these great shows, you'll enjoy a delicious served dinner with a choice of six entrees. Order tickets online at BroadwayTheater.com or call 914-592-2222. That's 914-592-2222. Come enjoy the summer weekends you've been waiting for with our Saturday Night Special Series all through August and only at the Westchester Broadway Theater.
Well, welcome back. This is Westchester on the Level, and my name is Hezzy Harris. There's just some very interesting news, which we hadn't heard about, but evidently Jonathan Bandler of the Journal News has gotten a story. You know, I guess it is what it is. It says it's about Zahi Jarrus, who's in prison right now. So it says here that Zahi Jarrus asked not to be present for sentencing, and evidently he's already serving a 4-year prison term for corruption, but yet it's Bandler says that he doesn't want to be present when he's sentenced on an unrelated tax fraud charge involving his Brooklyn gas station. So it seems that Jarrus is due in federal court in New York for sentencing on September 3rd, but he told the U.S. District Attorney Edgardo Ramos in court papers last week that he'd rather participate by live feed, either video or telephone, from the prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, where he's been since March. So Bandler continues to say, he said going to New York would affect his twice-a-month visits from his young son and daughter, as well as regular phone conversations with them. My children rely upon seeing me on those scheduled visits, and I believe that if the routine is disrupted, it will negatively affect them, Jarrus, who's 41, had written. And he continued to write, they know that Lewisburg is not a very dangerous place, and this reassures them that I am safe. So federal prosecutors on Friday asked Ramos for an additional 2 weeks to decide how to respond to Jarvis's request. The spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office on Monday would not say whether they opposed the request. Jarvis and his political mentee, it goes on to the whole issue about how he was originally incarcerated and so on. So I guess if you want to read the full story, you might just want to go to aloha.com. And the article was written on the 29th. That's yesterday. And it shows up in the paper today. So that's, you know, that's just very interesting and that's cool. So I think that that's it. We basically come to the end of the line. I want to thank Barry McGoey, the president of the Yonkers Fire Department, IAFF Local 628, for coming on board and telling us what's going on from the in the political landscape and with contractual situation still not being in place after 5 years out. So the last administration and this administration haven't found a way to sit down and work out the differences with the unions, not only the fire department, but the police and DPW and SEIU and CSEA and so many others. So these are important concerns. And on top of that, of course, Johnny Mack, Johnny Mack, and then, of course, John C. McMullen for joining us. It's been really an exciting discussion in the morning. So we'll speak to you tomorrow, and that should be fun with Senator Andrea Stewart-Cousins on the other end of the telephone. So be good, and thanks again. Bye.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.